This week on The Score, what is the future of student journalism? Who is against crony capitalism? Where did the polar vortex come from, and why is it making us so cold? Should we worry about the economic consequences of the federal shutdown? All this and more on The Score, so don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. This week's episode debuts on Groundhog Day. We were going to start off with I've Got You, Babe, but we were afraid you'd just press the snooze button and miss all the information and entertainment you're about to hear. By the time you do hear this, you'll know whether Punxsutawney Phil has seen his shadow and whether we'll have six more weeks of winter. Speaking of winter, our first guest today is Virginia State climatologist Jerry Stenger. I met with him at his office at the University of Virginia so he could explain to us just what this polar vortex is and why it is bombarding us with brutally frigid temperatures. I grew up in Milwaukee, and it got really cold in the winter. But I never heard the term polar vortex until the 21st century, maybe within the past decade. Is this a new concept or a new name, or is it just being applied in a different way?
The term polar vortex has come to the fore in the popular information lately. The polar vortex has always been there. Climatologists have referred to it often in general terms as the jet stream, the circumpolar vortex, the polar front, all sorts of names. It's basically the fast flow in the upper atmosphere that circles the pole, and it has lots of undulations and waves in it. And sometimes these waves will catch up with one another and amplify, or they will subtract from one another. We have long waves. They cover a long distance from east to west. And then we have short waves, which move through the system much quicker. In this particular case that we're coming up to now, we're seeing a very southerly dip in the polar vortex or the jet stream. And when we have a southerly dip, it brings cold air with it. The polar vortex is generally considered the dividing line between the cold air toward the pole and the warmer air toward the tropics. And where we see that, there can be a very steep contrast between the two air masses. So what's happening now is that we're getting into the really, really cold air that's dipping down on us.
The polar vortex, we usually hear about it in North America. I assume that it often dips into Europe or Russia as well, but and then it's on the opposite side of the world from us.
These waves in the polar vortex or the upper air jet stream wind their way around the Earth. So one location or another around the Earth may be under a southerly dip, which we call a trough, or a northerly excursion of it, which we call a ridge. So we may have Siberia under a trough at one point, western U.S. under a ridge, will be under a trough, and then this will migrate around and change very often as it goes around the Earth. So you may have Europe being very cold at one point or being unseasonably warm at another. This is very, very common. Sometimes we get some really deep troughs bringing some really, really cold air. So this is what's going to be happening now. This is what's happening now.
It is happening now. We're talking with Jerry Stenger, who's the state climatologist for Virginia at his office at the University of Virginia. And one of the questions I had was, as I'm reading news reports, it seems that it is colder in parts of the Midwest right now than it is actually in the Arctic. How do you explain that?
One must remember that a lot of cold air accumulates in the Arctic regions. It's dark up there this time of year, and the air just gets colder and colder. And sometimes that polar jet that circles the Earth forms a wave in it that blows some of that very cold air down to the south. So it leaves slightly warmer air further north. So a lot of times it's possible to have a very cold blast of air that's actually colder than it is, say, at the North Pole. This happens a lot in Siberia, too. In fact, because the landmass of Russia is so large, it tends to get much colder there than the surrounding waters. So there'll very often be a slight shift in where the cold pole, if you will, is toward Siberia. In fact, sometimes it forms a second pole, in a sense, in terms of centroid of very cold air. So it's not terribly unusual for us to have a flow that brings us colder air than you might see even at the North Pole this time of year.
You've explained that the polar vortex is just a way of manifesting the jet stream. And during the summer, fall, spring, we watch weather reports on TV and you see the jet stream moving. Is the polar vortex, because it gets in the news the way it does, is it unusually unpredictable for meteorologists, or is it just something that we should expect and it's hype on the evening news?
Well, the polar vortex, or the circumpolar vortex, actually in true meteorological definition is slightly different than what we call the jet stream, but we've been studying that for many decades, and it's quite well known, just that the term polar vortex has become more commonly used. So a lot of times it seems like, oh my gosh, a polar vortex. I hadn't heard of that before. Well, it's just one of those terms that climatologists have been using that didn't really make it to the evening news necessarily.
If this phenomenon had occurred, say, in 1975, what would people have referred to it as on the evening news?
I probably would have been referred to as the jet stream, or in many cases just an outbreak of cold air. So it's basically, if the polar vortex were to not be around, it would mean either the sun had gone out or the Earth had stopped rotating. It is simply a consequence of differential heating on the Earth and its rotation. It develops this flow around the pole, and that's totally normal. A lot of times the polar vortex comes into the news when you have a steep trough bringing very cold air, and the polar vortex is blamed. Well, yes, it is the polar vortex, and it does this. And also when it gets unusually warm for this time of year, that's also the polar vortex. It's just what it is, and it's that dividing line between the warm and cold air to a great extent.
So to clarify, this is not just a super cold front. It's a larger phenomenon.
This outbreak of cold air is what we would call global scale circulation. It happens from time to time. Now, some years you don't accumulate as much cold air up at the pole and then have it blasting down on us, or it'll blast down on Europe or Asia. So this is somewhat unusual, but it happens every few years. Interestingly enough, as cold as it is likely to get from this here in this part of the state, it will probably not break any daily cold temperature records. It's probably going to get down to around, say in Charlottesville, about 10 degrees, maybe 9 or 8 or something, as measured at McCormick Observatory, the long-term observing station in the area. However, for these days, the record temperatures go down to, say, 2 or 3 degrees. Mm-hmm. And that was set back in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. So it's not likely to be what we may call record setting. It'll certainly be cold, and you don't want to be out in it. And the winds, of course, will drop the wind chills to tremendously low values. And I can't urge people enough to be sure their pets are brought inside, because it's not going to be a good time to let Bowser running free.
And, of course, in the upper Midwest now with record cold temperatures, the mail's not being delivered. The schools are closed. As I said, I grew up in Milwaukee. You would never close the schools for cold weather when I was a kid, but it has to be really, really cold. My next question is, does the polar vortex in the southern hemisphere have is it felt differently than we feel it in the northern hemisphere because of the way the oceans are and such?
There certainly is a polar vortex in the southern hemisphere that circles the South Pole, and it, of course, circles from west to east down there. It's a little bit different in the way it manifests itself because there's not a large amount of land mass in the southern hemisphere. It's mostly ocean, and that helps mitigate things somewhat. The oceans are slower to warm up in the summer, slower to cool off in the winter. So we don't have these big masses of particularly cold surfaces down in the southern hemisphere like we do in the northern hemisphere, because the land masses we have here, of course, cool off more, and they lend themselves more to allowing the polar jet to dip down toward the south.
Which is probably good news for surfers in South Africa and Australia. My last question, we touched on this just before we went on the air, but that's there are polar vortices on other planets, and you mentioned that this is an issue for research right now.
Yes, we have every reason to believe, and we think we have seen in some circumstances a similar sort of circulation on other planets. A lot of times it's much more complex, and there are many, many questions about it. But it's certainly one of the things that climatologists are interested in seeing exactly how this works on other planets, and it might perhaps make it possible to lend some of that information to a better understanding of the circulations on Earth. But it's certainly a curiosity anyway.
In the 30 seconds or so that we've got left, do you have any comments about what we can expect this winter? We're feeling the polar vortex right now. What's it going to be like in a month?
As far as the rest of the winter goes, I do not have any good forecast for that. In fact, what's interesting is this part of the country, the Mid-Atlantic region, is notoriously difficult to forecast for, both short-term and longer-range forecasts. It's generally been shown that long-range seasonal forecasts don't work particularly well, if at all, in this part of the country, unless we have a really strong El Nino signal, which we do not have right now. So it's very difficult to give any reasonable predictions to what will happen for the rest of the winter. But I'm sure we'll have some cold days and probably some more snow.
Well, one of the things I think anyone who lives around here from Charlottesville to Richmond to D.C. knows is that you're always on that line, and it could either be heavy rain or a ton of snow.
We are indeed at the juncture of both warm and cold air, wet and dry air. And in many of these winter storm situations, we well know that a shift of 20 or 30 miles can make a big difference in exactly what you perceive on the ground. So it's not an easy area to forecast for. It's not like Minnesota at this time of year, where if there's something coming down, it's snow.
Or Arizona, where something coming down is sunshine.
Exactly.
Well, Jerry Stenger, thank you for joining us again on The Score from Bering Drift. It's always enlightening to talk to you. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Did you miss a previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at BeringDrift.com.
We hear a lot about corruption in government. Much of this entails what economists call rent-seeking, or using the government to favor one business against another. Our next guest, Nick Sorrentino, prefers to call this crony capitalism, and he is the co-founder of a web publication called Against Crony Capitalism. Here's Nick Sorrentino.
In a recent column, George Will noted that when Elizabeth Warren talks about corruption, what she's really talking about is rent-seeking, or what you might term crony capitalism. Is George Will correct, and what is crony capitalism?
Well, let me answer the second part of your question first. Crony capitalism is when private organizations, and it's not just industry, it could be unions and so on, partner with the government to essentially profit from that relationship at the expense of the taxpayers and the public at large. That's what crony capitalism is. As far as Ms. Warren is concerned, my feeling is that although she's probably concerned with rent seeking, it's much broader than that. She is probably at least as concerned with actual capitalism as she is with crony capitalism. Rent seeking is probably something she doesn't like. But property rights and profits, might also be on that list of demonic, sort of tendencies in the American economy.
Well, we're talking with Nick Sorrentino, who's a co-founder of Against Crony Capitalism and editor and publisher of thesorrentino.com. And let's expand on this a bit. What is Against Crony Capitalism, and why are you against crony capitalism?
All right. Well, Against Crony Capitalism, it was founded, I founded it with my business partner, Hunter Lewis, in the summer of 2011. And we wanted to chronicle the various instances day in, day out of crony capitalism. It was just a never-ending stream, and no one was really capturing it. And so we decided that we were going to do that, and I took on that part of the mission. And essentially, you know, we have an archive going back now 8 years, or almost 8 years, of pretty much everything you can possibly think of with regard to crony capitalism and rent-seeking and all sorts of stuff. And that's really what it is. It's a resource for everyday people. It's a resource for academics if they wish to access it. And it's pretty interesting reading. There's new stuff that comes out every single day. So that's what Against Crony Capitalism is. And by the way, our address now, you can access it going to againstcronycapitalism.org, but it's AC2 News now. For your information, just type in Against Crony Capitalism, it'll get you there. Why are we against crony capitalism? Well, you know what? Murray Rothbard made the point that if you really want to change, you know, essentially our crony system, our sort of soft fascist system, you got to point out to the everyday person that, you know, they're getting taken for a ride by the political class. And if nobody does that, then a lot of people just don't know. And so, in our small way, we've contributed to that effort.
Probably when people think of crony capitalism, they think of really huge, corrupt deals with the federal government and defense contractors or the, you know, major banks. But a lot of it happens at the local level, doesn't it? Like city councils and county boards of supervisors who are feeding their local supporters. Can you expand on that a bit?
Without doubt, crony capitalism is at all levels of government. You know, right on down to the dog catcher. I mean that's definitely the case, and in some ways it can be the most insidious form, the local kind. You know, somebody gets something zoned for their buddy. You know, other people's property rights get completely violated. You know, there are a million variations of it. Local regulation is brought up. you know, you got to get a license for this or that because, you know, Billy Bob down the road has a restaurant and doesn't like your food truck. It happens all the time. You know, and then on the other scale, you have, you know, the Federal Reserve and bailouts. You know, it's all over the place. And that's why we felt like it was such an important thing to address broadly.
So what can we do to prevent crony capitalism from taking place? Are there legal things we can do, or is it a matter of vigilance and, you know, making sure that our eyes are on what local or state or federal governments are doing with their business buddies?
My feeling is that crony capitalism is kind of the default setting for a lot of human society. I mean, going back to Hammurabi and probably before him, people were lobbying for special privileges through the government and so on. So we have to understand that. That's just the way it is. Now, it's like a fire that will always burn to some degree. The question is, you know, do we want to pour gasoline on that fire? Do we want to control the fire? Of course we want to. We want to do everything that we can to suppress that. Now, how do we do that? Well, we limit the enabling factor, which to a large degree is government. Now, this is counterintuitive to many of our friends on what is called the American left, who come to us and say, oh, well, we're against crony capitalism. We need to regulate these guys into the ground. Well, we certainly understand that instinct. However, what a lot of people don't understand is those regs are almost always written by the vested interests. And there's no way around that. The best thing one can do is reduce the state to the maximum degree possible and keep the economy as private as possible. And in so doing, you know, it won't be perfect, but it'll be significantly more transparent. And it will disempower the cronies in government. That's what we can do. And part of that is the public needs to be informed of it. People need to be ashamed of being a crony capitalist. You know, people often look at people who are rich and say, oh, yeah, well, times have changed or whatever. But, you know, you look at somebody and they're rich. Great. Wow, they're successful. Well, how about if they're unduly rich? That's an important factor. And you know, just staying on top of it and keeping people's feet to the fire and just kind of controlling, mess up the metaphor entirely, keep their feet to the fire.
All right. If I'm hearing you correctly, what you're saying is the fewer favors government can give, the less likely it will be people will do something untoward in order to get those favors.
That's exactly correct. Much better said than what I just said, but that is exactly correct.
Well, let's talk about some figures in the news lately. We mentioned Elizabeth Warren. There are people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, as she likes to be known, talking about raising the tax rate and making comments like there shouldn't be billionaires. What do you think of her approach?
Her approach, I think, is deeply is flat out uninformed. She is an enemy of property rights. She's an enemy of free markets. Socialism, by its nature, is crony. That's crony capitalism. It can be argued, I think, pretty effectively, is a form of socialism. You expand the state, there are always going to be cronies. You look at the Soviet Union, it was basically a country that was run by the cronies for the cronies. All right? And you look around in the socialist systems everywhere, that to a greater or lesser extent, that is the case. It is government run for the government class. So she thinks that, you know, if only good people would come in and, you know, we'll tax those billionaires into oblivion. You know, a lot of those billionaires providing fantastic services and lots of value to humanity, by the way. We'll tax them into oblivion, and that'll be more fair. And then we'll, you know, give everybody jobs in the government. Well, guess what? You just created a massive new crony class. Good luck, you know, dealing with that corruption going down the road.
There's a meme I've seen recently that says something along the lines of, before you criticize somebody for being too wealthy, ask yourself, how much wealth did they create for the rest of us?
I think that's right on the money. And it's hard to pull out because on the one hand, we look at people like Warren Buffett, all right? The guy is a crony capitalist in many respects. He's also produced a lot of value There's no doubt. In fact, my first real job, I worked for the guy selling insurance in college. But some of that wealth is ill-gotten. Some of that wealth is because he got the right regs at the right time. Some of that wealth is because Wells Fargo got bailed out. And pulling that out is difficult. It's much easier to say, rich guy bad, I'm poor, therefore I want rich guy's stuff. But that's fundamentally, I would argue, evil.
Well, in the 30 seconds we've got left, could you summarize what it is that Against Crony Capitalism does and where, again, people can find out more about it?
Again, it's basically a chronicle of crony capitalism day in, day out. So you go on there, you're going to see a few stories every day focused on the issue of crony capitalism. You can visit us at AC2 News. AgainstCronyCapitalism.org will get you there, too. And if you really want to go out there, you go visit me at thesorrentino.com, but that's a broader thing.
Okay. Well, Nick Sorrentino, thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift. I really appreciate your being with us today, and we'll have to do this again sometime.
My pleasure.
When The Score returns after a brief break, we'll talk to economist Bruce Yandel about the economic consequences of the government shutdown, and Tim Dodson, recently retired editor of the Cavalier Daily at the University of Virginia, answers my questions about the role of student journalism and its future.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.
That extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. That moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue. They know that a government big enough to give you everything you want is a government big enough to take from you everything you have. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm Rick Sincere. Starting just before Christmas, a big chunk of the federal government was shut down for more than a month. Federal employees missed two paychecks, which will be routed to them eventually, and federal contract workers were not paid at all. The economic consequences of the shutdown are far-reaching, as I learned by talking with our next guest, economist Bruce Yandel. More than 30 years ago, Dr. Yandel coined the term bootleggers and Baptists to describe a phenomenon when people who seem to be opposed to each other join together in support of a government regulation. I spoke to Bruce Yandel by telephone from his office at Clemson University in South Carolina.
We just finished a very long partial government shutdown, about 35 days. It's possible that in 3 weeks the government will shut down again. Could you tell me what are the economic consequences of this shutdown?
Yes, and it's a serious question, and so let's talk about it for a minute. I think you can put the economic consequences into two boxes. The first box has to do with lost economic activity associated with some 800,000 federal employees not receiving their pay. But then there are contractors. We don't have a good count on that, who are similarly situated. But let's just say it's roughly 1 million people who went without their regular pay, and therefore they curtailed their regular spending, and that worked its way through the economy. The other box has to do with why we have to have government in the first place. The purpose of government isn't to hire people. The purpose of government is to provide services and support for people and for the economy. And so those support activities, in many cases, screeched to a halt. Patents that might have been issued were waiting. Mergers that might have been approved or delayed. Food and Drug Administration experiments and trials of new cancer treatments had to wait. So on and so forth. And so there were lost opportunities that cannot be recovered when government starts. By comparison, in that first box, when the federal employees and the contractors start receiving their pay again, they will catch up. They'll get paid for time when they were away. And so in a sense, that gets recovered. But there are two parts. The one in the first box is the easy one to estimate, however.
We're talking with economist Bruce Yandel, who's affiliated with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University and also with Clemson University. And we're discussing the government shutdown and what it might do to the economy. And certainly within the government, the numbers are staggering. I heard of one woman who arrived at her desk and she had over 4,000 emails to answer. There's one government agency that issues permits for labels for craft brewers, and they have a backlog of 15,000 applications. How does this pile up in the government affect the economy at large?
Well, that's, I think, the more serious aspect of the effects of the shutdown. Just the kinds of things you mentioned and some that I touched on earlier. And that is what is so hard to estimate. But, as always, there's an effort that's being made, and there are some crude estimates that have been turned out. The Council of Economic Advisers made an estimate, and according to their estimate, there was 0.13 percentage points subtracted from GDP growth for every week of the shutdown. And so we had a five-week shutdown. Five times 0.13 is 0.65 percentage points subtracted from GDP growth. Now, I expect their estimate focused more on the salary and lost purchasing and consumer activities than it did on what you just touched on. But nonetheless, that is an estimate, and the estimate is based on some experience with shutdowns. The Congressional Budget Office turned out their report a couple of days ago, and they've indicated a number that squares with what the Council of Economic Advisers also estimated. And so, when we look at GDP for the quarter we are in right now, when it does get estimated, we will probably see a number like 2.1% GDP growth instead of 2.7%. In other words, that is the difference. But even so, as I mentioned earlier, I don't think that fully gathers the critical information about the delays and the catching up. The person who has 1,000 email messages to answer, I read where the Internal Revenue Service had over 1 million letters waiting in their mailbox. Getting caught up on those kinds of things, and even with the best people working, there are some things that fall through the cracks.
Can we add this loss to the GDP to what's also lost because of restrictive trade policy, for instance, and tariffs that are being added to the American taxpayers' burden?
Yes. In fact, until, I would say, December, there were a number of commentators who were looking at the U.S. economy somewhat in wonder, and for good reasons. We had accelerating GDP growth. We were seeing numbers in excess of 4% on a quarterly basis. We had continuing falling unemployment. We had estimates of consumer perceptions of the future hitting all-time highs. Everywhere you looked at data, things looked very good. Indeed, a number of commenters began to call it a Goldilocks economy. It was just right. So, as December passed, Goldilocks story, as you recall, ended not so happily when the three bears returned. Well, we had three bears to show up in December. We had a government shutdown, which is what you and I are talking about. We had trade wars and negotiations ongoing right now as we speak, negotiations with China. And then we had interruptions with respect to Federal Reserve policy and interest rate changes. Those three bears are growling. When all three growl together, we get multiple negative effects on GDP growth, also associated with a lot of uncertainty, where major decision makers and small decision makers, consumers as well as industrialists, can't quite tell what the king is going to do, and so there's a tendency then to wait, to postpone until the air clears. And so when we get those three compounding the problem, then it is possible that you subtract more from that GDP growth number, just as you suggested. I don't think the subtractions are large enough to put us into negative territory, however, which is to say, I don't think we have something happening that's going to push the nation into a recession in 2019. But what I do think we have are lost opportunities, and sort of the gloom has been taken off the economy. Goldilocks has come off somewhere. Maybe she'll come back one of these days. But it is a new, slower economy producing less wealth than has been the case in the past.
If the government shutdown returns after 3 weeks, which is a possibility, will investors and consumers become nervous again? And could we see the equivalent of people stuffing their cash in a mattress rather than putting it in a bank or in investments?
I think the answer is yes. We had data come out today that was reported on the Conference Board's survey of consumer confidence. It has fallen for 3 months in a row now. And that consumer confidence had been rising and had been hitting sort of all-time high levels. It has now been falling. And the people who do the survey do some analytics associated with it, and they express their opinions about what may be driving it. Government shutdown is one of the drivers. The sharp decline in equity values in December, another major driver. And so there are two discouraging effects there. I think if we get another shutdown, I would say it would have what I would call a bewilderment effect. That is, the first shutdown is having a real economic effect, and it's causing people to be cautious and to be somewhat pessimistic. I think a second one would lead to a feeling of bewilderment about leadership, political leadership, and how is it this country is going to be put together so that it can operate smoothly again.
Well, with that, Dr. Bruce Yandel, I think we can add bewilderment effect to the economics lexicon along with bootleggers and Baptists, and we'll try to spread that as a meme on the Score from Bering Drift. Thank you for your time today.
Good talking with you. Take care.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
As anyone who reads newspapers, follows social media, watches TV, or listens to talk radio knows by now, the state of the news media in the United States and around the world has changed substantially in the past 20 years. Many familiar newspapers and magazines are now just memories. Does journalism have a future? I spoke to an optimistic journalist at the University of Virginia who says yes. Tim Dodson spent a year as editor-in-chief of the Cavalier Daily, one of the nation's oldest independent student publications. We met at the newspaper's office on the grounds of UVA so I could ask him about the role played by student journalism in the media ecosystem.
What is the role of student journalism in the 21st century, specifically student journalism that publishes a daily or a weekly newspaper or magazine? What is the role of student journalists?
So I think there's a few things here. One part of that is that student publications are training future journalists, training future civic leaders, people across a variety of disciplines. I hope to go into journalism personally, but I think that in a lot of ways we serve as schools, as programs for people who want to go into the media industry. The other part of it is that there's a very practical application of what we do. We serve our communities. And so we are a source of information. We're a source of information for our campuses, and whether that's holding campus leaders and holding the administration accountable to more more lighthearted things like feature profiles on what student life is like at a particular moment in time. So I see that duty as really being a recorder of history, in the time and in the context and community in which we live.
We're talking to Tim Dodson, who until recently spent a year as editor-in-chief of the Cavalier Daily at the University of Virginia, and previous to that, he was managing editor. A paper like the Cavalier Daily, which serves a university community in a city that's part of a metropolitan area, is kind of like a neighborhood newspaper. It's got a specific niche. It's sort of a micro-targeted publication. How do you balance the coverage of events on grounds, academic affairs, and things that might be happening in the neighborhood, in the city, or in the nation?
Sure. So I think that if I were to look at the broad range of things that we cover, the majority of it certainly is UVA. But when it comes to local news, that's probably another 20 to 30% of what we do. And then when we cover national stories, they tend to be through the lens of how does this impact college students? How does this impact UVA specifically? So, for example, Title IX changes are being considered at the federal level. We might look at that and say, how do UVA officials feel about that? How do UVA students feel about those changes that might be happening? So that could be an example there. But I think that's an interesting point, because if you look at local newsrooms, they are cutting jobs. The Daily Progress has certainly reduced its staff levels over the years. I'm sure you could say similar things about other publications too locally. And in some ways, Cav Daily's in a unique position here in Charlottesville, because I would say we're the largest media organization by far. It's just people don't necessarily think about that. And I think sometimes our staff doesn't realize that as well. So in some ways, while other media organizations are certainly cutting staff, because we're a nonprofit, because we're a student publication, we don't necessarily feel the same pressures in the same way. So that does give us a lot of flexibility to cover things that perhaps other journalists and reporters might not be able to, given the other responsibilities that they have at their own publications.
Now, speaking of the changes in the media world, and there are 1,400 fewer newspapers in the United States now than there were 14 years ago in 2004. The Cavalier Daily used to print every day or 5 days a week, right? And now you print once a week?
Once a week, yes.
And most of what is in the newspaper has already appeared online, and I think most of your readers probably access it online rather than in the print edition. Is that correct?
Yeah, that would sound about right to me.
Now, how does that affect your advertising revenues and things like that?
So we have certainly seen we're not alone in this. We've certainly seen a decline in print revenue over the years, and that's been part of the decision to go to a reduced print load. We used to actually be twice a week in print, 2-3 years ago. So we did make a change fairly recently to once a week print, but that means that we need to be smarter about what advertisers we're working with, how we're trying to generate revenue. So, we've seen a greater shift in our advertising focus and in our revenue strategies towards our website, towards digital, but also other products like email newsletters. That's an area where we certainly have a large alumni base who's reading those, and so that's been attractive to advertisers as well. And we've been developing other online products. So we have something called ABCD Magazine, which is for more long-form pieces. And eventually, the hope is that we'd be able to monetize that as well.
The Cavalier Daily and other student publications are essentially extracurricular activities, mm-hmm. Volunteers. What kind of academic resources do you have as student journalists at the University of Virginia? Are there classes you can take and professors who advise you?
So I jokingly say that the Cav Daily is the journalism school at UVA. And there's some truth to that, because we do not have a formal journalism program at the University of Virginia. We have a media studies department, but that is much much broader than just journalism and news media. There are a handful of journalism-related courses that students take. Wyatt Andrews, a former CBS correspondent and reporter, he teaches a course on the news media, for example. But, you know, UVA does not have a J-School. And so that's what the Cavalier Daily has been able to kind of, we've kind of filled the void that UVA has in its own academic offerings. But, you know, there are student organizations that do receive funding from UVA through student council and through appropriations. So there are groups that are officially tied to UVA, but something that's unique about the Cav Daily is that we're financially and editorially independent from the university's administration.
And that's important for any student publication, even if you're talking about, say, high school publications, where the hammer of censorship often comes down pretty heavily.
Yes. Yeah.
In your tenure at the Cavalier Daily, in your tenure as a student at the University of Virginia, you have been covering local stories that have had international attention, like the Rolling Stone hoax cover story, the Hannah Graham story, the events of August 11th and 12th. What's it like being sort of in that fishbowl of being a hyper-local publication covering a story with international interest?
Sure. So I think that goes to my point about how student newspapers record the history of their communities. They record the history of their campuses at a point in time. And so we've certainly had a tumultuous series of years here at UVA. And so I think what our job has been is how do we, you know, we recognize that these are national stories. We recognize that there's a lot of attention being paid to Charlottesville and to our campus. But what is this like for students? What is this like for faculty, for administrators, for community members? How can we record their stories when the eyes of the world are on us? And so a lot of those, you know, when national publications come in or the national news media, they kind of parachute in for a few days and then they leave. They might come to a verdict. They might come to a court hearing or a public meeting, and then they're gone. And so the responsibility is on us to follow those stories from start to finish. And sometimes after an event has finished, there's still a legacy that we have to deal with. So the events of August 11th and 12th, I think not a day goes by that members of our staff and members of our community are not grappling with that in some way or another. And I think that that's our responsibility to continue covering that and following it, even when the national news media has pulled out of Charlottesville.
When the national news media is actually here, when all those satellite trucks are parked outside the courthouse, how do those journalists treat your staff? Do they look at them as equals or proteges, or what is it?
Sure. So I think there's two ends to that spectrum. One is that they're kind of dismissive towards us and they don't really see us as equals. But then there's been many instances where national publications have viewed us as a valuable resource. They've come to ask for our reporters to appear on air. They've asked for our photos and videos of events and our contributions. They've invited guest submissions. So I think that for the most part, our experiences with national publications and national news media has been quite cooperative. I think we're all in this together, and if we see something that other people aren't, then we're certainly willing to share with them. And I hope it goes both ways.
You want to go into journalism as a profession?
Yes.
That's kind of like when my sister was going into theater in the 1980s. What will it take to be able to make a living as a journalist in the 2020s, 2030s?
I think that journalists, in order to succeed, they need to be indispensable. I think that means that you have to be willing to serve whatever community you're in, but also be willing to learn a lot. I think, for me, I'm really interested in land use and development-related reporting, which is not quite a sexy topic, but that's a story that almost every community across this country is grappling with in some way or another. So that's a skill set that I'd love to develop and pursue at a publication somewhere. So that's still to be determined where I'm specifically going to go after UVA. But, I think journalism and the Fourth Estate, we're at an incredibly important point in time. But we have to figure out how to make it work. We've seen layoffs at BuzzFeed recently, at Huffington Post. So it certainly might look grim, but I think that just underscores that the work we're doing is more important than ever when there's fewer people doing it.
Yeah, journalism is at an inflection point where there are probably as many people like me doing it for free, if not more, than the people who are getting paid for it at major publications. And it's a changing changing scene in many ways. Do you have any final thoughts? You know, as you know, a couple months from now, you're going to be marching down the lawn. And what do you want people to remember about your time at the Cavalier Daily?
I would say that throughout my time on the Cavalier Daily, we've encountered a number of challenges. You know, financial challenges, including going to once a week print. We've seen challenges in our community. August 11th and 12th. Other major news stories that have happened here. But I think that for the most part, we've been able to kind of weather the storms that have come to our community and serve as a valuable resource. And so I hope that, my goal is that when students read the Cav Daily at UVA, they see something that reflects their student experience in some way or another. Have we fallen short of that? Sure. I'm sure there's instances where we have. But I think that I've really tried to dedicate the paper to that, and I hope that that's something that will continue to happen moving forward.
And that's probably part of the legacy that people in the past wanted to leave behind as well. Tim Dodson, thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift. I appreciate your time today, and good luck in your future endeavors.
Sure, Rick, thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Earlier in the program, we spoke to Dr. Bruce Yandel, a distinguished adjunct fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Just over 4 years ago, I interviewed his grandson, who is also an economist. Adam Smith collaborated with Yandel on a book called Bootleggers and Baptists, How Economic Forces and Moral Persuasion Interact to Shape Regulatory Politics. In this interview from the archives, I asked Dr. Smith about the bootleggers and Baptists concept. From October 2014, here is Adam Smith.
Adam Smith, can you tell me what the origin of the phrase bootleggers and Baptists was?
So the origin comes from Prohibition, where you had bootleggers and Baptists with aligned interests that didn't even realize they had aligned interests. You had Baptists saying, down with legalized distribution of alcohol, and you had bootleggers saying, down with legalized, distribution of alcohol, right? So it was a boon to the bootleggers, and the Baptists were kind of oblivious to that situation. And so what we see today in our modern political economy is many, many manifestations of the same kinds of strange bedfellows. And more we're seeing that those bedfellows are recognizing one another and coming together to form even more powerful would-be bootlegger Baptist coalitions.
What's the connection between bootleggers and Baptists as a concept and crony capitalism?
I think they're very related. There's even a line, I think, in the book where we call it bootleggers and Baptist capitalism instead of crony capitalism. I think what I hope the book shows is that cronyism is more than just a bootlegger. And I think that's the only thing that's usually recognized, right? There's just some special interest group. But a special interest group cannot move forward without moral cover. And so, or at least can't move forward, can't get much out of the political domain without the Baptist. And so I think we have to call attention to the bad work Baptists are doing in creating opportunities for cronyism.
Your book sets out a framework for understanding regulatory politics. So what avenues of research do you think are now opening up based on what you learned writing this book?
The biggest one, there's obviously a lot of empirical work to be done. So we've got all these social regulations that people aren't looking at in terms of econometric work in the same way that they are economic regulations, because we just don't think of it that way. We don't think of environmental policies and health and safety standards as giving money to anybody, right? We think of those as in the public interest. In other words, the Baptists have succeeded in convincing us of that fact. But that's just not true. There's a lot of groups that benefit from that legislation, and we need to put them under the microscope. We need to put those regs under the microscope in the same way that we do economic regs. So that's probably the most immediate. And I think second would be just recognizing that this is a useful framework for recognizing groups. As I said during the comments today, never count a good bootlegger down. And so a lot of times when we can't see the bootlegger, it doesn't mean they're not there. So maybe seeing the Baptists can call attention to the fact that maybe there's a bootlegger standing in the shadows.
Oh, well, thanks for your time today. I'm looking forward to reading the book.
Thanks a lot.
Well, that's all the time we have this week on The Score. For all the editors and writers at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Be sure to come back next week to hear more news, reviews, and interviews. Tell your friends to listen, too. We'll be waiting for you.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.